Hi everybody, good morning. Welcome along to this class. And for those of you online, welcome to this class called Samsara and Nirvana. So we'll begin as we normally do by taking refuge, generating the mind of enlightenment, say a few more prayers and then actually engage in the teaching. So to begin, please get yourselves comfortable in your seat. This means ideally that your spine is straight, your shoulders are relaxed, and your hands and feet are comfortable. Now you can close your eyes completely or leave them partially open. Now once you are comfortable and relaxed, just let your body breathe itself. And imagine that in the space in front of you, is sitting Shakyamuni Buddha, and his body is made of golden light. He is sitting on a throne, and he is surrounded by your spiritual teachers, other Buddhas and meditational deities, and so forth. Meanwhile, surrounding you are all sentient beings. You're all looking directly towards the Buddha. Now think that you are leading all the people around you in the safe direction of the three rare sublime ones, the Buddha, the Dharma, and his spiritual community called the Sangha. This safe direction entails freedom from suffering and its origins, and a path that leads to the true cessations of the origins. Now by leading all sentient beings in the safe direction of the three rare sublime ones, I think your ultimate goal here is to attain enlightenment to benefit all beings. And it's with that in mind that you entrust your body, speech and mind to the Buddha and his teachings and the community. So now please join me in saying, I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. You think that from the heart of the Buddha and the spiritual entourage, lights and nectars pour forth and they stream over you and all sentient beings surrounding you. These lights and nectars remove obstacles to your practice, and they empower the potentials of method and wisdom so that you can achieve total freedom from cyclic existence. You recollect the four immeasurable thoughts of love, compassion, joy, and equanimity, and you decide to establish these in your own mental continuum and help all beings do the same. And to affirm this, you say, may all sentient beings have happiness and its causes. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and its causes. May all sentient beings never be separated from the happiness that is without suffering. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from the bias of attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. Again, from the heart of Buddha Shakyamuni and the hearts of each enlightened being surrounding him, lights and nectar stream forth, and they wash over you and over all the people surrounding you. And all obstacles and hindrances to the development of the four boundless thoughts vanishes. And you find that these qualities are effortlessly manifested. You recollect the field of merit above you, and with the intention to create more virtue and to f- free the mind from suffering, and to increase virtue. Join me in saying this brief prayer. Reverently, I prostrate with my body, speech, and mind. I present clouds of every type of offering, actual and imagined. I declare all my negative actions, accumulated since the beginning of this time, and rejoice in the merit of all holy and ordinary beings. Please remain until the end of psychic existence and turn the wheel of Dharma for living beings. I dedicate my own and other spirits to the great enlightenment. Now prevent ourselves from clinging to the merit we've accumulated and the practices of purification. Recollect emptiness and the lack of true existence. And imagine your body, speech, and mind, your merits, and all the objects of the senses are utterly transformed through the realization of emptiness and reappear as a pure land. And this pure land you're willing to offer to the Buddha and his entourage. But join me in saying, this ground, anointed with perfume, stirred with flowers, adorned with Mount Meru, four continents, the sun and the moon. I imagine this as a Buddha field of offering. May all living beings enjoy this pure land. Idam Gurata Mandala Kamayatayami. So the Buddha accepts the offering of this mandala and he smiles at you, and you look up and meet his gaze. And looking into the eyes of the Buddha, you feel accepted, at ease, and confident that your practice will bear fruit. Now an emanation of the Buddha leaves his heart and moves through space and comes to the bottom of the crown of your head, facing in the same direction you are. The emanation descends down to the level of your heart. And resting there, it begins to expand, filling the body and the mind with light. It pours out through the pores of the skin, filling the 10 directions of space, and establishing every being within space to now be within the enlightened state. There's simply no difference between self and other. You think within this vast spaciousness you hear the resounding sounds of the mantra of Shakyamuni Buddha. And then you join in, reciting this mantra three times verbally and then a number of times under the breath. Taya ta omni. Maharmaya-soha Tayata-om-ri-ri Maharmaya-soha Tayata-om-ri-ri So here think that you've accomplished the purpose, your own purpose, and the purpose of others. Now the lights withdraw from the 10 directions of space. Now they ring into your heart. You feel embodied, being able to hear the sounds around you, you know, the cushion that you're sitting on. And you acknowledge that this meditation is one of imagination, and this process has imprinted the mind with conditions suitable for your own awakening. So rejoice in that. Potential for awakening lies within you. And breathing in deeply through your nostrils. Exhale through your mouth. And let your eyes flutter open and move your body in your own time. So again, welcome everybody. As you know, this is the seventh class in this module called Samsara and Nirvana. And to present it, I've relied upon these books here. Now, the primary ones I've relied upon are down the bottom here called Samsara, Nirvana and Buddha Nature. And there's another book on the other side just called Buddhism, with the two Buddhas there. These are really in-depth but easy to read. So really extensive coverage of this topic, Samsara. I mean, they're all terrific books. It's just that I find these ones, they're my main go-to nowadays because they just present every the whole path, and for me, it's easy enough to understand. Now, what have we covered? Well, we began with looking at Samsara and Nirvana. Can anybody recollect what Samsara is? I hope you can. We've had several teachings on it. The cycle of rebirth, which is under the control of karma and delusion. So you want to try and remember, like, what's this? If I'm not in control of it, what is? So we look at Samsara Nirvana, we look at the Four Noble Truths, we look at delusions and the three sufferings that are contained within the First Noble Truth, and we've also looked at the 12 links. So we've done a lot, actually. And if you can't remember a lot of it, that's okay, because there's a lot of material also in there. Now today we're going to have another look at the Four Noble Truths from a quite different angle. So we're going to look at this, what they call the three cycles of explanation. In other words, each truth was explained in three ways. And then we're going to look at the attributes of the truth of suffering, the First Noble Truth, also called the truth of dukkha. The truth of origin also has four attributes, and so does the truth of cessation and path. So we look at these, and why we need to look at these is because what we normally do is perceive these attributes wrongly. So we have what we call these four correct ways of looking at each truth, and there are four wrong ways of looking at each truth. So we have to know which one's which, right? And we can identify, am I looking at this truth in the correct way or the wrong way? And then, of course, what's the benefit of reflecting upon each of these four noble truths? So we talk about these three cycles. So in other words, we go through each of the noble truths. We always end up with this in the nature, how to engage in this truth, and what's the result of the engagement. So in other words, we're sort of identifying what each phenomena is, how to engage with that, and what do you realize once you've engaged in it. So in terms of the truth of dukkha, so dukkha here is just the First Noble Truth. Often we know it's the truth of suffering. But as you know, suffering is not such a good word because we sort of only think of suffering in terms of physical pain, and suffering they're talking about is much, much more expansive and deeper than that. So they call it dukkha. So the first thing we need to do is to identify what is dukkha? What is the truth of suffering? It's saying here it's the polluted aggregates caused by karma and affliction, which is samsara. We start off with, what is samsara? So you gave me something pretty close to what's here. So in other words, your own body and mind, which are not under your control, they're under the control of karma and delusion. This is suffering. This is what we have to acknowledge. Most times, but you can separate them out and make one primary thing and then talk about a whole lot of other things. Okay. Yes, oftentimes I use the words delusions and afflictions together. No, oftentimes when they talk about afflictions, they're talking about not
the
karma.
That this is, to you.
I'm sorry?
The horrible things that
happen
to you.
No, so afflictions cause karma. So you're sitting here. So suppose we're both sitting here like this, and I say something to you that you don't like. Right? So that dislike of what I just said is an affliction. In response to the affliction that you're having, you maybe yell out at me or swear at me or something, just supposing, right? Now that's the action that followed the affliction. Yeah, that is an activity of an activity that will cause yourself suffering.
Yes.
Because it's rooted in an affliction. This is the noble truth of dukkha. the polluted aggregates caused by karma and affliction. First, we have to say, acknowledge, okay, this, if I'm talking about the truth of suffering, so what is it? You say, well, it's the aggregates which are under the control of karma and delusion. Oh, sorry, the polluted aggregates, the aggregates that are polluted.
The aggregates, that means us.
It's us, yeah. Well, right. It's tricky. What it's saying is the aggregates are form, feeling, discrimination, compositional factors, and consciousness. Or you could just simply say the body and mind of the person, yeah. of an unenlightened person. So please, when I use, if I start using too much Buddhist language and it becomes unclear to you, please, you know, say something and say, can you just explain that again, Eddie, you know, so I can understand. So once we can say, okay, this is what suffering is, this is what the noble truth of suffering is. It's like my body and mind that are not my body and mind that are not under my control. Whose control are they under? Karma and affliction. Now, if you disbelieve, this is very easy to check out. Like, you know, if you just sit here and just let your mind do its thing, right? Are you doing that? Are you under the control of your mind when you sit there? Like, you know, we sit to meditate and there's so much going on, right? We see it and we've got to try and get some control over the process. That's a challenge straight away. You're not in control of your mind. And none of us are in control of the body. But we do our best like going to gym and training, you know, we eat good food and do all these things. But the body's got its own life, doesn't it? It just gets older and more decrepit, and then it gets sick, and then it just collapses and we're dead. So we're not under control of that process. So what is? What are we being conditioned by? Is that karma and delusion? That's what's in control here. Okay, so in terms of true sufferings, true dukkha, or true sufferings, there are two types. One is called internal true dukkha, and the other is called external true dukkha. Internal is everything that's happening with our body and mind. External, everything else.
Yeah.
This is probably the simplest way to put it. And that's, you know, I'd best say it like this because, you know, sometimes I talk about phenomena of suffering, and you can look at a chair and go, well, what about the chair? Is the chair suffering?
It's aging.
No, we all say like, no, but under this way of putting it, it's part of true dukkha, it's externality. It has no control over itself, it's a chair. It's going to disintegrate, fall apart. It's under the control of causes and conditions. But you can look at anything external to yourself, and that's how it is. There isn't anything that has control over itself, external from your body and mind. Now, how do you engage with this understanding? Well, practice mindfulness of the four distorted attributes. That's what you're going to get introduced in the next slide, slide after. What are the attributes and how have they become distorted through your own delusions? That's how you engage in understanding this is the noble truth of dukkha. And what we're engaging in is our lack of control. So what's going on in this lack of control? Well, things are being misapprehended. Ourselves, all phenomena. All phenomena appear to us to be truly existent. They're not. It's a distortion. And this is what you have to do to understand dukkha. We've got to acknowledge there are these four distorted attributes, and then we can know what to do about them. And the result of this is that we realize that, yes, suffering exists on the conventional level. But ultimately, there is no suffering to be experienced. Ultimately, there is no suffering, no true sufferings to be experienced. There are no true sufferings. You see this a lot in the Diamond Cutter Sutra, right? So they say, one of the things they say, mind, there is no mind. Ultimately, there's no mind. Conventionally, there's a mind, but it's misapprehended. Ultimately, that mind doesn't exist. How does the mind exist? Clear and knowing. So yes, this is the thing, and you've got to keep bearing this in mind, that all conventional phenomena are empty of any intrinsic nature. And phenomena are appearing to us to have that intrinsic nature. So that's where you start off, you know, mind, the mind that appears to have an intrinsic nature. There is no mind that has an intrinsic nature. The mind has a nature of clarity and awareness. So this is the realization. And then this is how you understand dukkha fully. But see, if you go looking for your own suffering, you won't find it. This is what's on the ultimate level. So you don't find any true dukkha, you don't find any true suffering. Now, what are the four attributes of this truth? They are impermanence, that suffering itself is unsatisfactory, it's empty, and it's selfless. So right there, you got there's the clues. All the clues are right there. You have impermanence and unsatisfactory. There's the conventional truth of suffering. Empty and selfless is the ultimate truth of suffering. That's really good news. So briefly, that's that. Now, the next thing I've got, so I put up a slide like this. And what it does, it takes each of these attributes and then shows us where we go wrong and what's actually correct. So here, on the right side looking at it, you know, you can see it's got the bold, impermanent, dukkha, empty and selfless. That's how they are. On the left-hand side is the mistake we make about it. So all produced phenomena are impermanent. They're subject to change. You see, here they undergo continuous momentary arising and disintegration. Some of you might remember we talked about a subtle impermanence, but when the first moment takes place, when the second moment takes place, the first moment's not there. Now, like I said, if you look around you, you'll look at things and none of the things around us appear to be changing at all. And so what happens often is that we grasp at that unchanging appearance. Now, like, you know, sometimes you find, meet friends you haven't seen for a long time, say, oh, you're still the same. There's nothing same about them at all.
Oh, you meet them and they're all droopy and it's like, what happened?
Yeah, that's right.
I'm not like that.
Yeah, well, yeah, exactly, it's either side. Right? And then as you go through, right, so they are unsatisfactory or dukkha, because they're under the control of afflictions and karma, they're not under your control. This is not satisfying, is it? You have no control coming into this life, no control of what happens in this life, and no control going out. Now, this is just the truth of suffering. Remember, all this is it's not fixed. Yeah? It's the top one, the first one right there. None of this is fixed. It's all changeable. The second one here, believing unsatisfactory things to be pleasurable. So this is, there's lots of things that we like, but they bring as much suffering as they bring pleasure. And in the long term, they're no use to us at all. Like, for instance, I spend quite a time, well, I used to spend a lot of time, and I still spend quite a bit of time watching TV. Now you think about, like, what am I going to take from television and entertainment to my next life? What use is that to me? But I like it, you know. So this thing is actually, what I consider actually a pleasurable experience, is not satisfying in terms of rebirth, long-term happiness, all these sort of things, right? Basically, you're just filling in time, wasting time, and we never know how much time we've got in our lives. So then we've got this other side, they're empty. On one side, they lack this. So here, empty and selfless, like I said, these are really to do with the ultimate truth of phenomena, and they are putting it in the simplest way possible. So from a middle way consequence point of view, they look at these two, empty and selfless, and go, actually, that's you'll never get free just knowing that. What they really come for, empty and selfless, is about the lack of an inherently existent person, or that suffering has inherent existence. They say this is very useful, of course, but it's not the final say. But all the other systems agree with this, and this is why it's put up like this, right? So the middle-way consonants are going a little bit deeper. So you can see these four attributes are wrong and unhelpful. What should we remember of these? Well, some very simple things is to remind yourself that the body is not attractive. Secondly, the aggregates are not pleasurable. Thirdly, there is no permanent unitary mind. And lastly, persons exist in mere name. So this is the middle way consequence take on all this, right? Persons exist in mere name. All the other systems say that the person is probably the mind or some aspect of the mind. Now, this comes about, of course, through the four practices of mindfulness. So when you practice those four stages of mindfulness of body, feelings, mind, and phenomena, this is what you sort of come up with. It's what you need to remember. And so if you do all this, how, so this is why we've done all this, and we sort of realize that at some deeper level than where we presently are, right? How do we go about being in the world then? You know, to take this knowledge and make it ours. Simply you do this, right? I don't have control over myself, and neither does anyone else. So when people behave badly towards us, you can go, yeah, of course they don't. They don't have control over themselves. And my response, if I really had control over my response, it wouldn't be any problem, would it? But I don't. And that's why I hurt too. This is the thing. And this is what Geshe Tashi Seren used to say to us. What do you take home from this? And he said, you don't have control. You don't have control. Lama Zopa, in his explanation of this, one of the great metaphors he gives, he says, think of yourself as like walking around as an open sore. You get touched anywhere, like just the breeze, it hurts. And I was thinking, walking around the stupa there, wow, I heard this woman say last night on TV, she's so sensitive. I said, of course, that's what it means. You're a sensitive person, you're going to hurt. So what is this? You lack control of yourself. And this should really, like we say, sober us up. To go, okay. In other words, because remember it says, this is not permanent that you lack control. That's even in the first time, that all things are impermanent. So even the fact that we lack control at present does not mean it has to stay that way. We can make changes. And that's the whole idea of having a path to bring about the cessations, to actualize change and make sure they're stable. So these first two truths, the truth of dukkha and the truth of origin, are talking about our unenlightened life. The others are talking about the process of moving from unenlightenment to enlightenment. And so try to always remember there's four truths here. One is describing the bad side, one is describing the good side for us. Both are possible. And so the truth of suffering should dramatically alter your perspective on who you are and what might bring you happiness. Okay, do you have any questions just on this first part here? I mean, I have to just quite briefly, I look back at my other presentation, it's much more extensive, and I just keep thinking, and it was meant over 4 weeks, right? So I've just tried to grab the things from each one and get, what's the most essential points here? So you get a brief overview of it, understand what these attributes are and what you can do in relationship to them.
Yeah.
And so this is what I'm saying, we need to become familiar with ourselves and then move it across and go, just like me, they're the same. This moves it from personal suffering to universal suffering and compassion that follows from it. This is why it's really important to sort of slow down, because it could have been like Sadhguru could have been at this moment, because I'm just going to take the view saying that you don't have bodhicitta, right? And if you don't have bodhicitta, you've got to sort of bring it to mind at that time, don't you? Like you say, okay, for the sake of my enlightenment and yours too, I'm going to say this to you. Okay, so there's your motivation. But if it just springs up naturally, you know, what naturally does that? Afflictions, aversion. I don't like what you just said to me. I'm going to say this. Yeah, that's right. That's possible. Yeah. And this is, but like I said, this requires control over the mind. This is just like saying, look, this is where we are now. Right? And you get like little bits of control because it's a gradual process, isn't it? It's a path, right? It's not just you do one thing, hey, that's gone, I'm right now. All the control comes out of the understanding, right? And even understanding's not enough.
And then you could just ask, like, are you okay?
Yeah, like that. If you read, that was your first response, you know, then what can you not mouthful say? Like, okay. There's many different responses you can make, but you've got to sort of, you know, train yourself. Yeah, that's right. And but again, it differs from person to person what you can do. As you know, the stages of Dharma, for the beginner, for the intermediate stage, for the person who's really good at it. And you've got to find out where do you actually work. Perhaps you can't do the things you're really good at, and that's okay. What about in the middle somewhere? What about right at the beginning as an ordinary person going, well, that's over now. You know, you can recollect impermanence. You can recollect suffering, as Andy just said, right? But, I know mine, but I forgot about her suffering or that person's suffering. So if I could remember, this person's really sick too, you're not going to snap back at them. That's all the solutions are there, but you've got to find the ones that sort of suit yourself at the level of the path you're on. Okay, let's do our first meditation. So just adjust your posture, drop your shoulders, straighten your back. And just allow your breath to find its natural rhythm. Now form an altruistic intention that this meditation will help you understand your mind and serve others better. Now have you ever noticed how quickly your mood can shift from calm to agitation? This is because the mind applies four false filters to everything it sees, everything it engages with. And these distortions make the temporary look permanent and the empty appear solid. And so you begin to feel as if you're a victim of your own reactions. Now just picture your mind as a mountain lake. See its surface as being pure and clear and stable. Then imagine the wind stirring up the currents and mud starting to rise from the bottom. So have you felt yourself holding the thought that this situation is going to last forever? It's not going to change. They're always the same. It's always like this. Well, those are the filters. They're not the reality. Can you release those filters and just return to the breath? Now, does the idea of a solid and separate, independent self, or I. Solid, independent, separate identity. How does that feel? Often the sense of self feels sort of heavy and tense, the sense of worry with it. And these are the distortions. This idea that yourself is solid, separate. This is not your true nature. Would you be willing to experience this for yourself? to look at the eye or your sense of self and ask the necessary questions to see how does it exist. Now consider your own anger. Perhaps it's a reaction to a mistaken labeling process. By breathing slowly, you create space for clarity to return. So instead of quickly responding to the other and to, with words, just come back to the breath. Take a couple of breaths, then respond. And try to carry this sort of awareness into the day when strong emotions arise. Just pause and sort of step back for a moment. And when you do feel a strong emotion, in the stepping back from an immediate response, ask yourself, who would I be without this emotion? And then rest in the clarity of your truest potential. And now breathing in through nostrils, and exhale. And ask the blink and move about a little. So now we come to the next truth, the truth of origin. Again, it's got the three cycles. We identify what is the truth of origin. Well, this is the afflictions, especially craving and karma. This is the origin. This is the noble truth of the origin of suffering, or the origin of dukkha. How do we engage in this knowledge, with this knowledge? Practice to be mindful of the four distorted attributes, which we'll come to shortly. And then we know that these are the things that need to be abandoned. The result is that yes, on the conventional level, craving and karma are the origins of suffering. But ultimately, we find that they have no true existence. And when you know that, then you understand origins. In other words, we sort of say each time you're seeing this, we have to acknowledge the conventional truth of the phenomena, like here, which is craving and karma produce suffering. It is craving and karma that produce true dukkha. This is the conventional truth of phenomena. If I were to look deeply into this conventional truth, I would find that craving and karma have no ultimate existence, do not ultimately exist at all. I can't find them at all when I search for them. When I don't search, they appear right in front of me, truly. Now, the thing to remember here is, I use that analogy again when we looked at, you know, in this take karma and craving. Yeah, take karma and craving. There is no karma and craving. That's why it's called karma and craving. So we go again. So start off with the first one. Take karma and craving. How do we apprehend them normally?
To be inherently
existent. Great, thank you, Sandy. Next one. There are not inherently existent. There are no inherently existent karma and craving. Conventional truth, grasped, ultimate truth, dependent arising, therefore it's called karma and craving. You can do this again and again and again. It's a really great thing to do to your mind. I think, okay, when I apprehended mistakenly, ultimately, that nothing like that. How does it actually? Dependently. Upon name, it's the name of it. Yeah. So the last one always comes back to you going to dependent arising.
Yes.
Because that's how things conventionally exist. But the first one is conventional truth. But conventional existence is very different than conventional truth. Now, they're both conventions, but they're different. The first one, we're reifying it. The last one, we're not.
Anthea's just wondering, what are the four distorted attributes?
Thank you, Anthea. We're going to come to them straight after the slide. So the four attributes are that these origins of suffering are causes of it. They are origins of it. They're strong producers of suffering, and they're conditions for suffering to arise. So again, in the next slide. So here we go, again on the right side, you can see they are causes of dukkha because they're the chief causes of dukkha. They're origins because they repeatedly produce all the diverse forms of suffering we experience. They're strong producers because they act forcefully to produce strong suffering. And finally, the conditions, because they act as cooperative conditions. You look across the other side, and here we have believing that dukkha is random or causeless. Now, there's lots of people who think that. We call it bad luck. It's just bad luck. And there's a lot of suffering going on because people aren't able to identify the cause of conditions, and they think it's not fair.
Or people think, oh, it's just natural.
That's right. Oh, it's natural. Or the other is like, it's not fair. You know, a lot of people suffer because of that idea, don't they? And here's got nothing to do with fairness at all. You know, it's just cause and effect. Causes and conditions produce effects, and nothing to do with fear at all. So, dukkha is not random or causeless. Why? Why is dukkha not random or causeless?
It's based on karma and affection.
Thank you. Very good. That's right. Because it has causes.
It's my list of two.
Can you repeat that, please?
So, what was my question? Why is dukkha not random or causeless? Because it depends upon causes and conditions.
Which are?
Karma and affliction, or karma and delusion. Here's another one most people do, believing that our suffering is only one cause. Don't you do this yourself when you're suffering, looking for the single cause? Miffy and I used to watch a show on aircraft disasters, right? And they don't find one cause. There's never one cause. And it's the same with us. When you suffer, we're going to go, okay, am I looking for one cause? Because if I am, I should know that's a mistake straight away. There's more than one cause here. For instance, karma is one cause, but affliction is another. So it's always two. And there's this sort of thing too, isn't it? It's like, you know, suppose you have a disagreement with somebody. Well, there's two things right there. There's yourself and the other person. And then you're going to say something about the other person, them being a cause for your suffering. But you should know, actually, I've got the cause of suffering already. I'm like that open sore. Now somebody says the words, now I'm suffering. That makes you more patient. It doesn't get you to seem to retaliate straight away. It's like two sores running into each other, isn't it? You both do it.
Help.
Yeah. It's like that, isn't it? It's really, samsara's really messy and hurtful, painful. Yeah, this is what we've got to sort of get in the head.
And gross.
Yeah. The other one here is the third one, believing that dukkha arises from a discordant cause. So some people blame the devil, other will blame God, other will blame the weather, all sorts of things. But like I said, these are not. We look for them. What are the actual causes? Karma and affliction, karma and delusion.
I think that if I miss I'm wrong, that Christians would call it original sin.
Yep, they could say that. You might say that if your cause. Exactly, that's right. Yeah. And here's another one, believing that dukkha is fundamentally permanent, but temporarily fleeting. So this comes out as often as we, you know, if you're suffering a lot and it's painful, you can think that this is never going to end. This is like permanent. But then of course you do get a cessation or it doesn't, like it changes, right? If you've sat with people who are dying, this is not uncommon. It's really intense suffering and then it's like this pacification of it.
Also psychology says that you know, like you can have, you may not be angry all the time, you're angry every now and again, but it's always going to be there because that's natural, so there's nothing you can do about it. And is that true? Good question.
So when you think about this, this is the idea. So, okay, so now we know something about true origins. What should you be thinking about here? So if you think just like that last one, that suffering is fixed. I think I go, well, it can't be, because it depends upon causes and conditions, which are karma and delusion. If I don't have the delusion, how can I experience the suffering? You know, it's like the, this is the whole Buddhist narrative, right? Just remove the causes, you cannot get the effects. They use the example of the seeds all the time. If you don't put the seed down, you can't get the plant. No, it happens, right.
But
of course, this is what the whole idea. Stop putting down seeds. Every time you create a karma, you put on your mind strip another cause for suffering. The whole idea is stop it.
But you've been doing it for many lives.
Sure. Just like people smoke all their life and then they stop. Just like alcoholics drink for a long time and they stop. Why can't we stop our anger? Why can't, just because we're angry people, I mean, gosh, if we couldn't, what would be the point of training? Like, I'm not a very calm person normally. Like, I can quickly get quite agitated, right, and upset. It usually comes down pretty quickly. But it's not a pleasant way to live. You know, that's what we call, like, normal life. I don't like it much at all. To have arguments with your partners and misunderstandings, like that up and down business, I prefer to be without it.
Anthea says it's a gradual shift directly proportionate to our effort.
Thank you, Anthea. That's exactly right. If you don't put effort in, it stays the same. That basically, I mean, the process is. So first, you have to decide, look, there's nothing fixed here. This week just can bring as antithetic resilience. You've got to keep trying. If you don't keep trying, well, of course, then things don't really change, do they? I mean, they change, of course, but not under our control.
They get worse.
They get worse, usually. Yeah, that's right. That's exactly right. Bad habits get worse unless you do something about them to stop it. And of course, it strengthens your determination to be free. Now, just another thing about this. Yeah, when we first study these four noble truths, we do usually it goes like the first one, second, third, fourth. Right? Most people don't do third and fourth. Mm. They just get to the first one like that's it. That's how they look at it, right? And so, not such a good way of looking at the fullness of our life.
It's very depressing.
Yeah, that's right, it's very depressing. So here's the trajectory. First noble truth, I lack control. Second noble truth, it's not fixed. Don't forget. This is the idea, this is the thing you need to take, okay? Don't get stuck here. There's a way out. You know, it's like those guys who sort of get, you know, sentenced a long time in jail and they just stay in their cells, they do their time. And others just want to get the heck out. And it's possible for them to break out. Sometimes they're successful. It's the same here. We're stuck in the prison cell of samsara. But you can get out. Like it's not fixed. It's unpleasant being here, but it's not fixed. And the third noble truth and the fourth show you how to get out. Unless you do something about it. That's right. So we just leave that.
About purification. Right.
So part of the path of cessation, so we have a path, right? And so in that path, we have purification practices. But the very best purification and the actual path of freedom is the realization of emptiness.
It's the only one, isn't it?
Yeah, and so it's the only door to liberation. Everything else contributes to you opening the door and walking through, or you know, identifying the door, walking through. Right? Okay, let's do our next meditation. So again, adjust your posture, drop your shoulders, lengthen the spine, and let your body breathe itself. Then set an altruistic intention to understand the truth of origin. Thereby liberating yourself from cyclic existence and helping others doing the same. Now, have you ever wondered why your frustrations return even when you try to change your surroundings? While your recurring pain or frustration is not caused by outside events, it grows from your own mental habits. So when you see that craving and confusion are the sort of fire behind your troubles, then your desire to change them becomes your greatest strength. So awareness is like a clear and steady light that shows the exit in a darkened room. Have you ever felt caught in a loop of worry? Well, it's just the mind trying to protect and imagine itself. What happens when you name the craving behind the stress? Well, it begins to lose its power when you stop feeding it with your wrong beliefs. Like a fire that dies when the wood is removed, the stress fades when its source is known and removed. Can you acknowledge that your mind is the only tool that can truly set you free? If you discipline the mind with Dharma, and the discipline here is one of gentleness, freedom is possible. But if you do not discipline the mind with gentleness, well, we keep getting what we're getting, samsara. More karma, more delusion. Again, ask yourself, who would I be without this thought? Some space-like awareness should open up. This is just the mind itself. Do not pollute the mind by adding to it more confusion and more actions that follow from confusion. And breathing in through your nostrils, exhale. Now we come to the third noble truth, the truth of cessation. Again, we have these three cycles. We have to identify the nature of a cessation. It's called nirvana. So nirvana is the ultimate nature of the mind. You'll see this ultimate nature has no karma and affliction. There's none there. And so this is the noble truth of the cessation of dukkha. So anyone ask yourself, when you're standing, a thought arises, and if you ask yourself, who would I be without that thought, what happens to your mind? What happens? Just do it now and tell me. Open and spacious. That's my experience, Sandy's experience, anybody else. Yeah. Yeah, it's just awareness, isn't it? Open awareness, right? It's always there. It's always there. What makes us miss it is the thoughts and the emotions. They're overlaying on top, and you can't see the thing. What do we see? We see our emotions. We see we're confused. Anyway, like I said, but this absence of the afflictions and the karma is called nirvana. To engage in it, again, you remember the four distorted attitudes and don't engage in it. Engage with the four correct ones. And you say this, the cessation of dukkha must be experienced. So you can see here, this is not just an intellectual understanding, right? Or like I said, that little exercise there of going, who would I be? That's not nirvana, it's just the relative nature of the mind. The result, of course, when you do this, you go, cessations exist, truth is as if it's on conventionally. You can't find them ultimately. So in other words, nirvana has no ultimate existence. There isn't anything that has an ultimate existence. Nirvana does not ultimately exist. It's an ultimate truth, but it doesn't ultimately exist. In fact, there isn't anything that ultimately exists. So ultimate existence is just another synonym for inherent existence. And if you have the study of the Vinayaka, true cessation has been experienced by me. Now the four attributes of the truth of cessation are cessation, peace, magnificent, and freedom. So this is the good side, right? Doesn't it? You should look at it and go, oh, that sounds much better than the other side. And so we look at again these four attributes and then the wrong way of looking at it. So it's called a cessation of dukkha because it is a state in which the origins of dukkha have been abandoned. So the causes and conditions that produced dukkha and dukkha itself, they're not there. Now, I don't know, can somebody think of an analogy that would demonstrate this in the real world, in the ordinary world?
Oh, if you didn't have a DNA thing for a disease, then, you know, a particular sort of disease, then you couldn't get...
That disease?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Same sort of thing, if you don't have firewood to create a fire, you can't have a fire. You don't have firewood and matches, there's no fire. So the same sort of thing here, so if you don't have karma and afflictions, you can't have the result of it. Think if you could, it's like saying, wow, I want to win $1 million, but I haven't bought the ticket. I'll sort of get it though. That doesn't happen, right?
Fingers crossed.
Yeah. So here's this first one, look, the idea that liberation doesn't exist. So there's a lot of people that think that, don't they? Especially people who believe that consciousness comes from the brain. People think that consciousness is a major source of is physical, then liberation can't exist. So of course, when if we don't have the DNA, then you can't have the illness. If you don't have the firewood, matches and so forth, you can't have a fire. So there's an absence of the fire, there's an absence of the sickness, right? Nirvana is like an absence of causes and conditions that produce suffering. And this state is a state of peace. So when I did that one, when I asked you, who would you be? Right? Don't you feel just a moment that the mind is peaceful when you ask that question? It's like that, but at a much deeper level, which is getting at the ultimate nature of things, not the conventional. So you can see it's peaceful with the separation in which afflictions have been eliminated. Now, there are other states where it is very peaceful, and it has happened in the past that people have mistaken these states for liberation. So there are people that really like meditating, especially concentration meditations. There is a sense of bliss that can arise from it. And if you do it, if you develop calm abiding, for instance, there's the actual blissful state that you experience. And people could mistake that for going, wow, this is it. But there are no afflictions appearing, and I feel tremendous.
But this just also happens in day-to-day life, that if your health is fine and you've had enough sleep, you think everything's fine.
Yeah.
And then something happens and you go, oh no, what's gone wrong?
Well, this might be the very last one for the third one, if you're believing that a state of temporary cessation is nirvana. Yeah, we said, well, this thing, you know, this state is actually magnificent. It's a superior source of benefit and bliss. And the last one's like, yeah, but you know, but it doesn't last, does it? People won't think that. And they say, no, this is like a permanent state. It does not go backwards. You don't use the wisdom, realize of emptiness to get rid of an affliction, and then a little week later it comes back. That doesn't happen. You've got rid of the cause. The cause does not come back. So it's also got like freedom. It's a total, irreversible release. Again, it's like the sort of thing, you know, like the cause and the conditions aren't there. You're not going to have a fire. If you don't buy the lottery ticket, you haven't got the money, you can't have the result.
So do you think that meditation process is a little preview of
nirvana? That's done with karma biting?
Yeah.
No, different thing altogether. And you have the same sort of thing with insight. Right? So what happens is you get a bliss, a really pleasant state, and the body and mind, especially karma body, the body becomes very flexible. Like you won't feel old like we do. And sitting down for long times doesn't hurt you, all that sort of stuff. Right? There's a general well-being. The same sort of thing happens with special insight, though. So it's this idea of integrating them and then, again, keep going. You know, it's another mistake people can make is that having one of these states, that's it. It's like, yeah, so you know, when you, like I said, if you are in the Hindu tradition, many traditions of deep concentration. Now, so you do get to states where they are blissful, they can even seem to be non-dual. Right? But still, like, if you come out of it, Sandy's just saying Buddhist teachings are the only spiritual teachings that are teaching about this true cessation. You have to go, yes. You had to reflect upon them daily. Like, don't stop partway. That's what it's all saying. Once you get a taste of this, once you're convinced, this is doable. And of course, the thing that really convinces you is just into the path of seeing. And the path of seeing doesn't last very long. It's like a flash, it's like bang and next thing into the first ground. But it removes 80 different misconceptions that you have, and they're not going to come back. And you will know that. So a lot of ways that we used to think, you won't ever think like that again. Now I hope some of you had the experience of like this already in your life, right? Where you thought something and then you discovered to your horror and dismay and probably to your suffering too, it wasn't true. And you don't do it again. I don't know if it's happened to you, but like a simple example, I think. Now, some person, for instance, was once a criminal, and he did criminal acts, and they got him into jail. Well, he got to jail for a long time, and it was bad in there. Right? Suppose then he gets released, right? Now, I hope he'd be half smart to go, I'm not doing what I did before.
Yeah, but there's lots of criminals that do exactly the same thing because
they haven't figured it out. But there are others who don't.
Yeah.
That's the thing, you've got to find the ones who don't. Because there's lots of us who just keep in samsara and there's only very few that get out.
Yeah.
And it's like the person you have to make your mind up.
That's right. And even if you get out, then you just straight back in again. It's like we're recidivists in samsara.
Yeah, because those prisoners go back because they don't know another way. They have
sufficient
rehabilitation.
That's right. Exactly right. So we here are rehabilitating ourselves, aren't we? Our whole way of thinking, speaking, and behaving. It's preliminary. Just we need a foundation before we can get the wisdom in that. And to me, we seem to be interested in doing that.
Putting ourselves back in the box.
Well, I was thinking, Sandy went down to the courts today to help you know, to the company. What do you call it?
Like people who have court dates,
yeah.
Court hearings, yeah.
The same thing as well to support them, right? Just like to be there. That's the thing, yeah, so the Bodhisattva comes back again and again to support others, helping them get out, helping them bear the sufferings of samsara, giving them lessons how to help, how to help. Yeah, so it's just saying, look, don't stop partway. I mean, I think if you're into the first part or the path of renunciation, what's it called? What's the first path called, Biffy? You've got path of preparation, isn't it? Path of accumulation. No, it's accumulation of preparation. Accumulation. So on the path of accumulation, you've either entered the bodhisattva path or you've entered the path of the hearers and solitary realizers, right? But one of them is a path where you've realized renunciation. Right? And the other one is one where you've realized bodhicitta. So you're not going to stop. This is what I say, don't stop once you realize this. Keep going. And you'll see in the Heart Sutra it says, go, 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 go beyond, keep going. It's all like that, right? This is what it's trying to tell us here. Once you get a little taste of this stuff, and especially seeing our teachers who have more than a taste, right? That should give us all confidence to go, okay, it takes time, it takes effort, I'm going to do it. So here we go, the path now. So we have to identify, and here's the Noble Eightfold Path. I didn't find anything to say identify the five paths or anything like that. It's just said this. And this is the noble truth of the path out of dukkha. Practice, again, mindfulness of the four distorted attributes. The path has to be practiced. It's not like you get one realization and it's done. It's not like that. Again, on the conventional level, yes, the path exists. Ultimately, a true path does not exist. And this is when you realize the cessation is being realized. Interesting, isn't it? The last one, right? The path leads you, the path produces the cessations. You do something, something happens. The final cessation. It's like they're saying here, it's nirvana, it's called, this is the actual thing. But from the Mahayana perspective, you'd have to go, it's Buddhahood. Four attributes of the truth of path, like it is a path, it's suitable, it's an accomplishment, and it delivers. Now, the four mistaken thing, like it's a path because it's an unmistaken path to liberation. So you see on the other side where people go, there's no way out of this. That's a wrong misconception. Again, thinking that wisdom might not be the means to develop this path and bring about the cessations. The third way, believing that worldly paths, look, we're just talking about deep states of meditative absorption, just feeling good, that can eliminate dukkha. It doesn't. What it does is suppresses it while you're in that state. You come out of the state, it comes back. There. So, what was that story you told me a long time? It was about envy. Was it with Scott going to university?
Yeah.
So, you know, like the other one. So, you might have, like for me, I said one time, you know, I'm not a jealous person. I've never experienced jealousy. I think this is cessation of jealousy. I'm not a jealous guy. And then something happens out of the blue, and then you find you are. And it's shocking. So why was it? Well, how come what happened? And the answer is the conditions changed. Now the conditions are in place, and your past jealous mind, now it's ready. Up she comes. So it wasn't actually, remember, it just hadn't happened yet. This fourth one, last, believing that afflictions in dukkha cannot be removed completely. Or that once removed, they can reappear. So So really this path is made up of like the conventional and the ultimate. So what we're doing here is we're looking at conventionalities, which appear to have some sort of true existence about them. We examine, is this the case? Are they actually truly existent? We find they're not. And what you do is you keep your mind on that absence. And then you come out of the meditation, and then you do it again. And then you do it again, until you actually move from that state to the next part of your path. But they said that this whole thing takes you one countless great eon. So a countless great eon is the beginning, middling, and end of a universe of meditating on emptiness going through these things. I know it might seem a bit discouraging, but just remember, we've been here over countless lives. And we'll be here still over the next countless lives if we don't do something about it.
And it's not that all that time is useless.
No, not at all. Yeah, so we have these are distorted conceptions. So of course they'll go up online, you can always go back and look at them. But there's some really, like I said, some simple ones that you might find you do yourself quite naturally. Like one is always looking for a single cause for your suffering. That's a natural sort of thing to do. But there ain't a single cause.
And then being super happy to find that it's that politician's fault.
Yeah, that's right.
And then leaving it at that.
Yeah, and then see what happens. So how do we reflect upon these? This sort of thing should encourage us. So these you see in the path of cessation the truth of cessation and path, it's really about encouragement and not stopping. Once you realize something, like if you discover this is true, then geez, keep going. It's like, suppose you would come to a crossroads and you want to know, like, I wanted to get to, I don't know,
Paris.
I was just thinking that. I was thinking Paris. I said, oh, is that right? Anyway, so, you know, I just watched a movie called Band of Brothers and they do that. You know, the road to Paris is this way. And the road here is that way. Right? So if you're on the way to Paris and you can see the Eiffel Tower in the distance, like, keep going. Right? But if you take the other road and hang on a minute, where's the Eiffel Tower, where all the things are, so you go, geez, I don't think I'm going towards Paris there, I need to stop. Well, and get back on the right path. But once you see, you know, your destination, like I said, all you need is a glimpse of these types of freedoms, and that should be enough for you. You go, oh my gosh, I know.
You know, when Venerable Gendon was here, having a glimpse of someone who's got a glimpse of it.
Yeah, that's right. There's another, that's right. I mean, that's basically what we're about, is that we see people who are much better than we are, much calmer, and then they tell us they weren't always like this. Like they've been training. And wow, there are a lot of nice people now. Yeah, well, it could happen to me too. Okay, last meditation. Again, just adjust your posture, drop your shoulders, lengthen the spine. Let your body breathe itself. And insert an altruistic motivation to benefit everyone you meet. So, have you ever wondered what it would be like to look at the mind and find no trace of anxiety or fear? This complete state of lasting peace is often called a cessation. And if you can find for yourself that this peace is real, to move from coping to actually transforming your life. So all those stress can feel like something very solid and permanent, is it? Well, it's not. It's just simply a collection of habits that can be untied. So I wonder, how you would live if your deepest purpose was to help everyone find a state of peace. You would need to be a peaceful person yourself, but being that person, you could act like a bridge, you know, using your own progress to show the way for others. And now we do experience moments of calm and peace. What if you viewed each one of those as a glimpse into your own future potential? It's a small spark that eventually leads to full awakening. So if you know that total freedom is your destination, can you stay present with yourself? Can you carry that quiet presence confidently into every encounter you make? Don't just decide to do so. Make that your intention. Think, I wish to bring peace to the world, I need to discover peace myself. And breathing in through your nostrils, exhale, with your eyes further open. So today we looked at these four noble truths and these four sort of misapprehensions we have about each one. You know, like in the first order, but for example, truth of suffering. Suffering is impermanent, so we do not want to think of it as permanent. In terms of its origins, suffering doesn't have a single cause, it has many causes. And so there's benefit in knowing these. So like I said, the first one is acknowledging that you're without control, but being without control is not a fixed state of being. You can change.
That's a really good kind of life raft to hold on to. Yeah,
that's what I was thinking, looking through this. So how do you join this together? Present, we lack control of our body and mind. That state is not fixed. Gaining control over the body and mind depends upon a path and the eradication of everything that holds you back. That eradication is called a cessation. You stop getting in your own way, in other words. You stop hindering yourself. Okay, so if you can get access to any of the teachings on the Four Noble Truths, have a look at them, have a listen. Try to memorize the four aspects of the first noble truth. Like I said, like the way I just saw it recently, are the two first aspects, what is it, impermanence and unsatisfactoriness. They're this conventional nature, the conventional, and empty and selfless, the ultimate. And coming up, we'll be looking at the three higher trainings and renunciation in our next class.
Last minute question from Anthea about, is she right in thinking that bodhicitta is mainly focusing on improving ourselves to develop courage to find the voice to stand up for others?
Say that again, please.
Well, it's quite a long question.
Yeah.
So in our culture, we're often brought up to think we're being rescuers. And that can be all tied up with your own sense of identity.
Mm-hmm.
But with bodhicitta, it's about trying to develop your own courage and everything for others rather than your own identity.
Sure, yep. I'd agree with that.
So it would be the opposite to being a rescuer as such.
So, I'm not sure, Anthea, but I can see there's some benefit in using the word rescue. The thing is how the rescue is accomplished. The rescue is done by empowering the other person. You can't like just pull them out yourself.
So probably, so if you say the modern psychology term would be something like codependent.
Uh-huh.
But I also remember Rinpoche changed a lot of the prayers to specifically say our saviour.
Yeah, that's right.
Because we need a saviour like the Buddha to help us because we can't do it by ourselves.
No. And yeah, most people like say can't rescue themselves. So yeah, we need to play our part in helping to rescue them. And so if you look at the way that was done through the Buddhist narrative, it was through teaching. The Buddha teaches the other person how to save yourself.
Yeah.
And then it's up, the other person has to do it. So it's a bit like that, Anthea. Sandy's saying that one of the roles of a teacher is to be present with the student. Just like a parent is present with their children, don't they? This is how the knowledge gets shared and the examples are set. Okay, so we're run on time, so let's dedicate. Due to the merits of his virtuous actions, may I quickly attain the state of the Buddha and lead all living beings without exception into that enlightened state. May the supreme dual bodhicitta, not yet born, enlightened Buddha, may that born have no decline but increase forevermore. And as long as space remains, as long as sentient beings remain, may I too remain to dispel the sorrows of the world. Of course, holiness is long life. The wish-granting, wish-fulfilling jewel, source of every single benefit and happiness of this world. To the incomparably kind Tenzin Gyatso, I beseech. May all your holy wishes be spontaneously fulfilled. And the prayer for Rinpoche's swift discovery and return. In holding and spreading the Moon's precious and complete teachings through explanation and practice, you wore the armour of patience and was never discouraged. Incomparable Venerable Guru, to you I make this request.